Okay, let's get started. I have project 3. This is project 3, right? Yeah, project 3 to be returned, but I'll do it at the end of the class because we're already 1:40. I'm sure you can pick it up for me before you leave. So today my plan is to complete the discussion of handling time and change in probabilistic reasoning, and then next class onwards I would do learning, machine learning, some number of classes starting next class. A very important issue is figuring out a date for the makeup class. I have pointed out to you guys that I'll be gone on November 28th. Which is the Tuesday. I mean, I'll be missing the Tuesday class in the week after next. I won't be here. So I would prefer to actually have a class, an extra class, before I go away, because I think after Thanksgiving, people are in no mood to learn. It's just, you know, it looks as if it's all over. So I would rather try to do it before Thanksgiving. So I know that there is no single time when everybody is actually available. So what I would try to do is, as usual, I'll try to get a time when majority are available, and then I'll do the lecture, and I will obviously keep the slides as well as the audio. I am trying to see if there is any way of videotaping it. It may or may not be possible. So I don't guarantee any videotaping. And also it probably won't be in this classroom because this classroom is not available any other time. So I'll most likely just do it somewhere in the brickyard. Not brickyard, yeah, brickyard, yeah. So in the other place, I'm not sure. Yeah, so I have two options. So next week is the Thanksgiving, right? Next week is Thanksgiving. So I have two options. One is we could do a class on Monday afternoon. The other is we could do a class on Wednesday afternoon. And I just want people to, by show of hands, obviously nothing matters here. So if you can make to a class, obviously around this time probably, 1:42, 3:15, 1:42, 3, not 3:15, 2:55, yeah, I probably go at 3:15, but anyway, 1:42, 3 on Monday, I have a mild preference for Wednesday, just so that if people haven't picked up what happened on Monday, they won't be lost on Tuesday. Okay? And I actually like teaching the class on the afternoon before Thanksgiving. You know, it's just, we are the only people on the campus, and it's like we'll have a lot of fun. I seem to do it all the time, so, and unfortunately this time I don't get to do it, because it's Tuesday, Thursday. So let me try first Wednesday. Okay, Wednesday, 1:40, 2, 3. How many people are available? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 8. We'll count. Wednesday, 1:42, 3. Yeah. No, it's okay. If they showed up, they showed up. Okay, 21 on Wednesday. Wednesday, 3:15 to 4:30. Okay, so I think we have a winner. Okay, what I'll do is I will make a room for Wednesday, 1:40 to 3:30, and let you know. Okay, and so whatever happens in that Wednesday class would be the continuation of the next Tuesday's class, obviously, and then you will have time all through the Thanksgiving weekend. Instead of eating turkey, you get to figure out what I was saying in the class so that you will be ready when I come back Thursday, the Thursday after that, okay? And I'll do my best in trying to, since this is sort of being imposed on you, I'll try to provide, maybe after the lecture if I can, I'll try to provide some extra summaries and so on. You know, I mean, the best of course is if I just can have the session taped, videotaped. I don't know that it's likely to happen. Okay. Good. This is good. By the way, did I tell you about the AAAI 2006 Best Paper Award winning paper? It has something to do with raising hands. So it turns out that here's an idea. Suppose you have a large stadium, a very large stadium, okay, and you want to compute, you want to estimate the number of people in the stadium, in this entire large stadium, without actually counting one by one. And asking people to say, you say you're one and pass it on, would work, except it'll take forever, because everybody, you know, so you have to say one, and the next guy will say two, three, etc. So everybody has to actually take part in it. So the processing would be of the order of the number of people in the stadium. Right? Can we do something faster? And here is an idea, and why is this interesting? It's interesting because suppose I have a large SAT formula, you know, propositional satisfiability, remember that? So most of the time in propositional satisfiability, we were looking for an interpretation that satisfies all the formula. Suppose instead I wanted to count, given a large number of, you know, SAT formulas, I want to see how many models are there, the total number of models that are for this, that are actually valid for this set of problems. Now, why is this interesting? Counting models is quite interesting if, in fact, you want to do probabilities, because the difference between propositional satisfiability and probabilistic reasoning is, in one case, you just care whether or not there is a model. The other case, you care how many models are there. Okay. So there is a paper, so this is kind of connected. It turns out that the counting of SAT models is connected to this idea of counting the number of people in a stadium. Okay, and here is an idea of doing the number of people in the stadium. You ask everybody to raise their hands. They're all given a quarter, or they have a quarter already with themselves. Okay, so they all raise their hands and they have a quarter. Okay, they toss the quarter. If it comes heads, they get to put down their hands. The guys who got tails, they still keep their hands up. Now, every time you toss the coin, this is a synchronous tossing. All of them toss the coin at the same time, and they look at their coin, and if it came heads, they put down their hand. If not, they continue to hold their hand up. And then say, next iteration, everybody who is still left with the hands up, toss their coin. If they come heads, they'll continue, they'll put down their hands, otherwise they'll continue to hold their hands. Now you count the number of these iterations, that's connected to the number of people in the stadium, and it's not that hard to figure out why. Okay, and it turns out that this idea is manipulated to actually count the number of models for a SAT formula, and the guy who did this got the best paper award in AAAI 2006. Which is this year. So raising hands is good, you know. Okay, Project 4. What's going on with Project 4? TA seems to be even more happy than others. I guess nobody is even asking questions. So the question is, I did say aspirational deadline. I like this word, this phrase. I never understood what it meant. Basically people say our aspirational peers, that means the people who we would like to be, but we have no hope of being, you know. It's like my aspirational lookalike is maybe Brad Pitt or somebody. So the question is, this is an aspirational deadline I set for Thursday, but I am willing to extend it if people need the time. Okay. So how about we do it till next Tuesday, okay? And then hopefully that I'll revisit the issue then. Okay? Because anyway, I don't have the next project ready yet. I have to actually do machine learning so that you can do the next project. So may as well pass on the savings. Okay. Any other questions? Any other questions? None. I'd like to have one more, but it depends on the timing. Because if I do enough of machine learning, then I can do a project on machine learning. But that's what I'd like to do. Yes. What do you mean? What do you mean? If you didn't use it last time. Yeah. This is, I gave it to you free. So you can ask for extension separately. Yeah. I don't know. You can sell them in black market, believe me. I would suggest keep them. You can sell them. Others? Other questions? Okay. So I did send the current grade standings in the class. I haven't added the third project yet, but I don't know. I mean, it might change a little bit, but approximately you know what the marks are, etc. If there are things that are worrying you, my general feeling is if you are still around here, then I would like you to continue the course. Okay, I mean, before I couldn't care less, but since you are here still, you shouldn't give up now. Okay, so if you are worried about your grade, come and talk to me. And if you have questions, come and talk to me. I'm not going to change your grade, but I would do some morale boosting, okay, so that you'll feel good. Okay. So, last time we were talking about temporal sequential processes in probabilistic systems, and these are all review slides, and we talked about the issue of the world state versus the evidence variables. We talked about the Markovian properties, whether it is a first order versus second order versus nth order Markov. And we also talked about the stationarity of the process. Markovian properties essentially are talking about whether how many of the past states are you dependent on. Okay, and stationarity is whether the way xt minus 2, let's say you're a first order process, the question is, do you have to provide a conditional probability here which is different from one here, which is different from one here? In general, that might be the case. But if you have stationarity, then you can essentially say that I just need to provide one conditional probability. Okay? That's basically, in this particular case, it's called the transition model, because how the t minus 1 state affects each state. It's a system transition model. Okay? And we also looked at, obviously, if you have evidence variables, in essence, you have, this is your transition model, and if it is stationary, then this same model holds here too. So the same CPT. Okay? And then this is your evidence model, or the sensory model. What this is saying is, how is the actual value of the state influencing the evidence, the observable variable? Okay? And so normally with stationarity assumption and evidence, stationarity assumption and assuming that the sensory model also doesn't change over time, then you can provide a network like this. You can parameterize this network by just giving one transition model and one sensory model. That's it, which is great, because in general, actually, this if you think of this as a Bayes network, this Bayes network is going on and on and on. And yet, you are actually able to say what you want to say about the network by just giving that part. Okay? In doing this is essentially called dynamic Bayes networks. A dynamic Bayes network is really a template. Okay? A template, so for example, that RAIN model, so this is the full Bayes network, you know, it just keeps going. Okay, if you want to consider dynamic Bayes network version of it, it's just this template. And you're saying you can unroll it as many times as you want. Okay, this is how zeroth interval affects the first interval, first time, and then time 1 affects time 2 in the same way, time 2 affects time 3 in the same way. Okay, so a dynamic Bayes network is just a template. And now, one interesting thing, of course, is everything I'm saying about dynamic Bayes networks is over and above everything I already told you about Bayes networks. Okay, it's a dynamic Bayes network, it's just a special class of Bayes network. So we have to keep remembering that, and I will try my best to make sure that you will remember everything about Bayes networks in talking about this. Okay, so in particular, you know that in Bayes networks you want to cut down, it would be nice if you could reduce the number of probability numbers you have to provide. When you're doing stationarity assumptions and Markovian assumptions, you are reducing the number of probability distributions you have to provide. If it's stationary, then you just give one such table. Okay. Furthermore, we also talked about how you could parameterize these CPTs. So for example, if there are multiple zeroth level variables which affect multiple first level variables, this is just a specific dynamic Bayes network. You know, you could also have a dynamic Bayes network where there are 5 variables per state, and some of them affect some of them in the next state. Okay? And so for example, here is another Bayes network where the state is determined in terms of 3 variables, battery, the velocity, and the position variable. And the battery at the zeroth level affects the battery at the first level. That is the level in the battery. So this is like a automobile situation. Okay. So the level of battery in the zeroth time affects the level of battery in the time interval one, in the time instant one. And the level of, and the velocity affects the next time velocity, but the velocity also affects the position. Okay. And position just affects the position. And battery also affects the velocity according to this. So here actually this is a dynamic Bayes network too. Okay? What's more interesting, actually in this case it so happened that within the state the variables don't have any more links. So the variables are truly independent of each other. But that's not necessary either. So for example, by the time you came here, you have 2 variables which are really observables, which are connected to the rest of the variables. And it's also possible that you actually have a general, you know, topological structure here. Okay, so this is intra-state dependencies versus inter-state dependencies. So you could have a Bayes network, which is kind of the entire thing is transferring over time to time. Yes.
Multiple values.
Yes, that's the thing. So in fact, one of the nice things you will hear today is this view of dynamic Bayes network is so general that many things that, you know, there are many, many special cases that have their own little subfields. Okay, for example, we'll see that Markov chains and hidden Markov models are a particular special case of dynamic Bayes network. And similarly, Kalman filters are another particular special case of dynamic Bayes network. And dynamic Bayes networks are already a special case of Bayes network. Okay. So dynamic Bayes networks are templates for specifying the relations between the values of random variables across time slices, and we call them templates because they need to be expanded, unfolded, you know, to really reason about how, let's say, zeroth level variable will affect 15th level variable, for example. Okay. Now, you know, the usual terminology is you call this the transition model, how the state transitions from one position to, from one time to next time. And this is called the sensor model, because how the sensors work on the state to generate the observable variable. So that's the usual name. Okay. Now, because this is, dynamic Bayes networks are just a shortcut for Bayes networks, right? Everything in dynamic Bayes networks is a special case of Bayes networks. So in general, in Bayes networks, what is the usual kind of inference that you do? If you have a big Bayes network, right, you would say, I know these have the following values, and tell me the posterior distribution over these. So I can ask for a single variable saying, What is the probability distribution of x given y is true, z is false? Okay, y and z then become the evidence variable. This is the usual Bayes network inference you do, right? That's what you did in the project 3 that you just completed. Okay, so now, however, it turns out that there are special cases of these which have special names in the dynamic Bayes network, okay, our temporal model. Okay, they make a lot of sense. In fact, we talked about these last class already in general terms, and I'll just give you formal names for these. So, for example, one particular type of inference is, what is the probability distribution of the teeth level state, given the evidence you have accumulated from first level all the way to the teeth level? So, given all the evidence you have seen till now, what's your best guess as to what is the current distribution? So for example, if I have this rain, right, what's the current distribution of rain being true versus rain being false at the 15th level, given you have seen umbrellas at the first level, second level, third level, all the way up to 15th level? Okay, this is just estimation of the state. This is estimation of the state. As you see more and more evidence, your understanding of what the true state distribution is keeps changing. So the name for this task, of course, notice that this has the same general syntactic form as any random Bayes network inference task, which is conditional probability distribution given some evidence. That's what you're computing. Except here, you're computing xt given evidence from 1 to t. This is called filtering, okay? And it's also called state estimation. So you're trying to estimate your state based on all the evidence you have gathered till now. Okay? Now, if you have this, so what is the expected distribution of the state at t plus kth level, given all you have seen up to kth level? That would be not just current state distribution, but from here on, how does the state evolve? Okay, now this is actually this is just a special case of, so what you do here is you can find out the distribution at xt given all the evidence, and after that there is no evidence, right? Because after t there is no evidence. Okay, so from xt to xt plus k, the variation is only based on the transition probability matrix. Okay, so in general, let me give you one more point, which is, how do we actually reason about a network like this? This is a very simple network, right? So given the distribution of, let's say, so given the distribution at the zeroth level, that the range 0, then I can compute the distribution of the first level, okay, using the transition model itself. Having computed that, knowing the evidence, using the Bayes rule, I can recompute the expected distribution at t minus 1. Now that is, so t minus 1, I'm sorry, this is not a good picture. Yeah, so I'm here, to go from here to here, I use the prior on the rain and the transition model to get the rain 1. So just the transition, just if you don't have any evidence, based on the fact that normally it rains 70% of the time, okay, what's the probability and that, you know, the rain persists using this model, what's the probability that it will be raining in the next time instead? You can compute that. Having computed that, now you actually have seen the evidence. Based on the evidence, you adjust your distribution again. That adjustment is done in the Bayes, using the Bayes rule. Because what you have is rain actually causes umbrella. You know what the umbrella's value is, so you invert it to get the rain distribution. Okay? Having done that, now you have the true distribution of rain given the evidence up to this point. You do the same thing again to the next level. Okay, and if there is no evidence, after this evidence stops coming, let's say, and I still want to know, is it going to rain at the 15th step, All you can do is just keep transitioning it over the transition matrix. Okay? So this is basically one aspect is filtering, the other is called prediction. So if you are trying to guess what happens in the future, you are predicting. If you are trying to guess where you are, given all the evidence you have got till now, that's state estimation or filtering. Okay? The word filtering is actually not something that people from computer science have heard much of, but it's very popular in electrical engineering. Okay, so you're trying to figure out based on the evidence what's the state of the internal state of the system. There was a raised hand. Yes.
So if you have two systems, say in one system you have the evidence all the way up to 14, mm-hmm. you're trying to predict the field based on 0 to 14,
mm-hmm.
and another one you have evidence only 0 to 1,
mm-hmm.
and you're still trying to predict 15. So would the extra evidence that you have, so you're trying to do prediction in both cases,
mm-hmm.
would the extra evidence change the transition function?
No. That's the thing. That's the whole point about Bayes network. Transition is transition. Evidence is evidence. And Bayes rule helps you combine them. We'll actually look at some numbers in a minute. Okay, but transition is transition, evidence is evidence, and the Bayes rule combines them. So that's a nice thing. Okay? So let me see actually since we are talking about this. Yeah. Okay. So here would be the sort of filtering example you'll get. Okay, I'll get to how you computed this in a minute. So in this particular case, suppose you started with rain being equally likely, you know, 0.5, 0.5. Okay? Using the transition matrix, you would have thought rain at 1 also is equally likely, 0.5, 0.5. But then suppose umbrella 1 is true, then using the Bayes rule, you update your distribution to be 0.818 and 0.182. Having seen the evidence, you increased. Now, in fact, if the umbrella was false, it would have gone down from 0.5 to 0.3. Now, having done this, now this is the best distribution for rain 1, given all the evidence you have. You know, in general, you don't have the choice of do I use the evidence. I mean, that only Bush has. You don't. Okay, so if you have evidence, you use it. Okay, and so once you have the, since this evidence is available, you actually have that particular posterior distribution. Now, this is now the best expectation you have of rain 1. And then using the transition matrix, you compute rain 2 would be this. Now, if I did not tell you anything about umbrella, you would have assumed that rain 2's probability distribution is 0.62 and 0.37. So, if I did not have this evidence, this would have been a prediction step. Because I have this evidence here, this is filtering. And if I didn't give you this evidence, it would be a prediction. If I now throw in the evidence, then that evidence is used in the Bayes network, the Bayes rule, and you get 0.883 and 0.117. So what's happening here is actually because as the number of umbrellas is increasing, your probability that it is actually raining is increasing. Furthermore, because it rained yesterday, you expect it to rain more today. This is, you know, obviously it conforms to your intuitions about how things work. And again, with respect to your question, you notice that these two are different steps. This was caused just by the transition matrix, and then this is using the Bayes. We'll get there in a minute. Okay, so there is filtering, there is prediction, there is smoothing. What is smoothing? Smoothing is given all the evidence you have up to the teeth step, what is your best guess as to what really happened at T minus kth step? This is your Chernobyl nuclear reactor example. So if you asked on Wednesday, do you think there was a core meltdown in Chernobyl? You may say, no, not likely. But having figured out all the way up to Thursday, you lived through Thursday or Friday and found all these nice radioactive cloud on top of you, then you change your belief as to whether core meltdown occurred on Wednesday. It's the backward direction. But the backward direction is not causality. It's just the evidence at the lower level diagnostically increases your belief in terms of the K-1. So in this particular case, I'm saying smoothing is what's the probability what's the distribution of kth state given all the evidence up to kth state, where k is less than t. That's smoothing. Okay. Now notice all of these are just conditional distributions. You just gave them separate names, and it makes sense. It corresponds to your intuitions of prediction versus figuring out where you are versus figuring out where you were based on where you currently are. Okay, I'll get to you in a second. So in fact, this also even you don't even need to go to the Chernobyl nuclear reactor. If you woke up in the middle of the night in your friend's home, I won't ask you where, why you woke up there. Okay, you have some approximate idea as to the layout of your friend's home, but you don't quite know everything. Okay, you don't know whether you are in room A or room B when you woke up. So upfront, your expectation of that you are in room A or room B is like 0.5, 0.5, let's say. As you start walking around, you start hitting walls versus, you know, pushing off alarm clocks and everything. And based on this, you might remember that, oh, by the way, it's in the room 2 that there is an alarm clock. It's in the room 1 that a dog sleeps, so and you just walked on the dog. Okay? Based on the extra evidence you gathered, you changed your belief as to where you were when you woke up. This idea is, so you're localizing yourself based on evidence that's coming. So you're localizing your state k instances back based on the current evidence. We do this all the time. Okay? Yes? Which one? The number slide? That one. Yeah. Which one? This one, rain 2, right? So what's your question? Is this dependent on, so this can only be dependent on this and this. Would you agree? That's your base rule. Base network rule says rain 2 can depend both on its immediate parents and its immediate children. Can only affect rain 2 through rain 1. This is actually a good question that he was asking. Notice that umbrella 1 has no connection to rain 2. The way umbrella 1 affects rain 2 is by changing rain 1. Right? And it's the same way in the backward direction. It's, suppose you're sitting here and you suddenly, suppose there was no evidence, and so without evidence you went from here to here, 0.5, and some went from here to here. That would be a slightly different number than 0.2. It's actually, it will be again 0.5. And then you got the umbrella information here. Okay? Based on the umbrella information, these numbers come here then. Okay? So now you know it is raining here. That means your belief that it was raining in rain 1 has changed now. But it changed not because of umbrella 2 directly, but because of rain 2 and the diagnostic direction from rain 2 to rain 1. Okay? Other questions? Yes?
I don't remember anyone asking such a last class, but you remember that if you have smoothing, if you are knowing smoothing, is there a possibility that you can, even though it's in the diagnostic direction, is there a possibility that you can keep going around in circles until it all converges from the, well, to the.
No, smoothing.
If you go smoothing, when you're doing smoothing, you go look at past variables. Because you have new evidence on the future.
So your worry is, you know, is there like a positive feedback cycle? Because of future I change myself, and because of myself the future changes itself. It won't happen because it's a base network ultimately. That's like a zeroth level explanation. There won't be any cycle. Okay? That's a good question to worry about. Okay, finally there is one other type of inference which is also useful, which has a name. Special name. Notice that all of these are just normal Bayes network inferences. Okay, but depending on extra constraints on what you are conditioning on, you change the name. Okay, this is the most likely explanation. Okay, so given the evidence from E1 to E1, E2, etc., to E g, what is the your best guess as to X1, etc., up to XT? I'm no longer asking what is just XT. I'm asking what's your best guess as to the most likely state values. Okay, so if I've seen umbrella, 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 no umbrella, no umbrella, 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 you know, obviously the states could have been rain, rain, no rain, no rain, 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 etc. So the question is, of the rain, no rain sequences, of the many rain, no rain sequences, which sequence is the most likely one that could have caused this evidence? Okay? And this is actually quite useful because in many cases, in fact, I think the book actually talks about the direct connection between this and speech recognition. Okay, so when we are trying to say some phonemes, we make these funny noises using our epiglottis or whatever, I don't know what it's called. And these noise, and then that has been corrupted by the ambient noise, and then corrupted further by your sensor, your friend's ear, and then your friend is getting these signals. Based on these signals, your friend is trying to figure out what is the sequence of phonemes you are trying to say, and moreover, what is the sequence of words you are trying to say. And oftentimes, the middle word may actually sound, in a middle word in a long sentence might actually be hard to figure out what it was. But based on the context, you wind up changing that. The most likely word could have been this. Okay? So this is, again, a useful thing. In fact, one of the interesting things in understanding the most likely explanations is you don't get to do this by computing until here, right? All of these are asking for the distribution of a variable at a single time instant. The distribution of variables here at a t time instant, this is t plus k time instant, this is k time instant. This is the joint distribution of variables over 1, 2, 3, all the way to k instant. So this is actually a joint distribution. These are single, if you're thinking of single variable networks like this, single variable networks like this, then all other guys are single posterior, this single variable posterior distribution, whereas most likely explanation is a joint posterior distribution. Okay? And you can't figure out the most likely explanation by figuring out what is the most likely value of x1, what's the most likely value of x2, what's the most likely value of x2, x3, etc., xt. That's not going to work. That would be the first thing you will try to do. Because, you know, you could always have done this using smoothing and filtering and figure out for each xi what is the most likely value of xi given all the evidence. And it turns out that the most likely individual values of xi are not the same as the most likely sequence of xi that would have caused it. That's why in the middle of a long sentence, I could have sworn that you said, you know, a different word. But then you couldn't have said that given the entire context. Okay. So this is sort of nice to know that these are all different types of inference techniques over the same Bayes network, you know, which have nice names. Okay. Now let's look at how we can actually compute some of these. And in particular, for the rest of the class, I'll mostly focus, it turns out, on just filtering, because that's easy enough. Okay. So let's do inference on dynamic Bayes networks. Okay. What do we do? The simplest idea, of course, is if I have this RAIN network that I showed you earlier, and I'm going to be asking you questions of RAIN up to 5 and evidence up to 5, then all I need to do is extend this all the way up to 5. So if your evidence is available only up to level 5, okay, then I can basically unroll this network up to here. This is a big Bayes network, and just you give this to your Project 3 Bayes network tool, and it will answer every query. Because it answers any Bayes network, it also answers this query. Okay. The only piece left is, can we do something special given the repetitive structure of the Bayes network? Okay. In particular, what you would like to do, especially in things like filtering, filtering is like a fundamental operation in these kinds of Bayes networks, which is, given what I know, where do I think I am? Just localizing myself. That's what it is. You know, given all the evidence I got up to now, where do I think I am? And you keep redoing this as evidence comes. You know, step 1 to step 2, step 2 to step 3, step 3 to step 4, and so on. So you should be able to do filtering fast. Doing exponential time filtering is no good. So in particular, you'd like to see if there is some sort of a constant time operations you can do to go from one level to the next level. And I already showed you that all filtering involves essentially is taking the distribution here, pushing it through the transition model to get the new distribution, pushing it through the Bayes rule, using the evidence, to get the final distribution. That's what filtering is all about. Okay? And when you do this, you would have come up to this level, and then you can forget about this level. If you're only doing filtering, what you can do is you can mop up behind you as you are growing in the forward direction. So in fact, really you don't have to ever expand the base, dynamic base network all the way to K level. So as you generate the K plus 1 level, you remove the Kth level because you don't need it anymore. Okay? So that's what we will try to do. Okay? And to do that, obviously you could do that using basically the exact inference methods or approximate inference methods. Remember we talked about two types of methods for Bayes network, exact and approximate. So we'll look at how the exact method changes, and we'll also look at how approximate method changes. Okay? So let's look at first the exact method. It's very simple. This is essentially just the probabilistic, this is just in the formal notation what I was showing you earlier in that picture. You know, go through the transition model and then use Bayes rule to recompute the Fourier distribution. So what this is essentially saying is, right, so I am taking, this is basically what I'm trying to compute. What is the state at the t plus 1, what's the distribution of the state at the t plus 1 instant, given all the evidence from 1 to t plus 1. Okay? And I can write this way. All I did was I split the evidence to 1 to t and t plus 1's level. That's not wrong, because that's just a convention. And that can then be rewritten as this. So this is probability, the evidence at t plus 1 given the state at t plus 1 and the evidence up to t followed by, multiplied by probability that t plus 1 given the evidence up to t. Okay? So now the interesting thing comes now. We can actually use the Bayes network to realize that this can be cut out, because the evidence at t plus 1 is shielded from the evidence at the previous layers given the parent. Remember the structure of the network. Evidence at t plus 1 is shielded from all this evidence if I give you this. See, it's useful. What we learned earlier was useful. Okay? So, basically, I now say that this is nothing but this. Evidence here, t plus 1 given x t plus 1. Now, what is evidence of t plus 1 given x t plus 1? Do you know where it is? That's just the sensor model. Because evidence of t plus 1 given x t plus 1 is the same as evidence of t given x t is the same as evidence of t minus 1 given x t minus 1. It is the sensor model. So this can be read off from the sensor model, right? Now, the only thing that's left is this. Probability xt plus 1, the distribution of xt plus 1 given evidence up to t. This, essentially, you realize what's going on. What's going on is I'm looking for a distribution of rain 5 given evidence up to umbrella 4. So you know what's going to happen. What's going to happen essentially is up to here you wind up doing both transition and the Bayes rule, and then here you just do the prediction. Okay? So in particular, one thing you can do is, let's see, where are we? Yeah. So this probability xt plus 1 given e1t can be written, you can always take this and conditionalize it on an extra variable. Okay? So I would decide to conditionalize it on xt, which is the tth level state. And I'm doing this because xt plus 1 only depends on xt. Okay? So if xt is true, what is the probability of xt plus 1? And if xt is false, what's the probability of xt plus 1? Okay? So I can do this for each value of xt, and then I sum over xt. Okay? Now when I write this, of course, I do have to, so this basically, this has been written as probability xt plus 1 given xt even t and probability xt given even t. So all I said essentially is the way this guy is affected by all the evidence here is that he is affected by this guy, and then this guy is affected by the evidences up to that point. Now the interesting thing is, if I ask you how is this guy affected by evidence all the way up to this point, that's just a recursion of how is this guy affected by evidence all the way up to that point. So I got my structure back. So essentially what I wrote now here is, so xt given e1t, this is just the recursion. I went from xt plus 1 given e1 to t plus 1 to a subcall on xt given e1 to t. And then this number I know, this is the sensor matrix. These numbers I know, right? This is the transition matrix. How is xt going to affect xt plus 1? So I converted everything into something that I know. So that's your exact inference on this network. Okay? So that's essentially what was going on when we did this here. So you went from here, you got your expected value of rain 1, just using the transition model, then you got the, using the evidence, you recomputed the distribution, and then you went forward. Question? Okay. That's easy. Essentially what we did, again as I said, what we did is we are sort of writing xt plus 1 given e1 to t plus 1 as some function of t plus 1th level evidence and a recursive call to xt given e1 to t. And that function is basically this form. And so that's how you set up the recursion. Okay. The next I want to look at is the how can the approximate inference change. By the way, these are all just examples. I mean, I'm giving you some idea as to how exact inference methods can be changed to work in dynamic Bayes networks. But we know that there's not a single, it's not that there's only a single exact inference method for dynamic Bayes networks. Okay? What I did actually is sort of a variation of the variable elimination method, where you eliminate the previous level variable as you go to the next level by summing it out. Okay. The next one is actually more interesting in some ways. This is, you could, you know, how would you handle dynamic Bayes networks of this form using approximate methods, sampling methods that we discussed. So you could think of actually this lecture as another sneaky way to remind you of what we did in the dynamic Bayes, in the Bayes network inference algorithm, because we are applying them again. Okay. So for the approximate inference, we talked about various, two techniques we talked about. One decidedly worse than the other. We talked about rejection sampling. So make a sample, see if it agrees with the evidence. If so, keep it. If not, throw it away. Right? And then you, when you're done with this, then you look, your denominator is the number of samples which are agreeing with the evidence. And the numerator is the number of those samples where the query variable has the value true. Okay? So that was a very simple idea. Right? And we said that doesn't work. Does anybody remember why that doesn't work? Why doesn't rejection sampling work well? Exactly. So the idea is most of the samples are likely to be thrown out. So you'll spend a lot of time generating a sample only to throw it out. So it's not contributing to the numerator, it's not contributing to the denominator, so you just wasted a bunch of effort. So then we talked about likelihood weighting, which is a way better idea. Okay. What we did was once we make a sample, by God, we're going to keep it. Previously, a sample would be either one, has the weight one or weight zero. Weight zero means it's not even being considered. Weight one means it's being considered as a full sample. And in likelihood weighting, what we did was we will let the sample, we'll generate the sample while clipping its value to be the evidence values that you know. Okay? And to make it have the, make it agree with the evidence, you would then reduce its weight. Okay? And so in the end, each sample may be a fractional weight. Fractional weight is better than zero weight. And so likelihood weighting tends to get by with fewer samples because it winds up having reasonable numbers in the numerator and denominator, much before rejection sampling does. So what we'll do is, since we already know likelihood weighting is better, we will use likelihood weighting in dynamic Bayes network. And it turns out that in making likelihood weighting work for dynamic Bayes networks and exploiting the structure of the dynamic Bayes networks, we actually will come up with this nice idea called particle filtering, which is pretty nifty idea. Okay, and it's, in fact, particle filtering is used in many scenarios where you have arbitrary dynamic Bayes networks, including robot localization tasks, and I'll show you a video of it if I get the chance. Okay. So again, it's nice to know that it was this lowly likelihood weighting that we already understood that's going to be changed so that it becomes a much nicer idea called particle filtering. Okay. So here is the idea. Normal likelihood weighting takes each sample through the network one by one. Do you remember the slides I showed you? We had, I believe, sprinkler, wet grass, rain. What is the other one? Does anybody remember the entire network? Oh, okay. What? Let me see. I'm completely confused now. What was that network? Cloudy, rain, sprinkler. Oh, okay. Cloudy, and then sprinkler, wet grass, right? No, rain. Oh, okay. And then wet grass. We had a network like this that we looked at. And in doing this, suppose if I happen to know, so the way likelihood weighting would work is, suppose I happen to know that sprinkler is yes, sprinkler is on, okay? So first, I would toss a coin using the prior distribution of cloudy to get my cloudy truth falsity value in my sample that's evolving. So if originally cloudy is 0.5, that means it could either be cloudy or not cloudy, then I toss a coin which is, you know, a fair coin. And then if it comes heads, then I will say cloudy is equal to true. Now that I have decided cloudy is equal to true, I do know that sprinkler has to be yes. There is a CPT here which tells me if cloudy is equal to true, what's the probability that sprinkler is yes? That's likely to be small. So now, as the penalty for taking sprinkler to be true without actually tossing a coin, I will say that my evolving sample is now going to have whatever is the weight that is there here. So for example, if cloudy is true, sprinkler is true is, let's say, 0.3, then whatever my evolving sample currently only has cloudy equal to true, and now sprinkler also equal to true, but then already I know this is only as good as 0.3 or less. Okay, this is what we were doing. And then obviously I also get the rain value, I also get the wet grass value. Now if any of them are evidence variables, then in those places that 0.3 will get multiplied again by another small factor. Okay? This is what likelihood weighting was. So one thing I want you to remember is you do this one sample at a time. You would push one sample all the way through the network and you get its weight and keep it in one column, and then again push another sample through the network, get its weight. That's what likelihood weighting does. Okay. Now if you are going to use likelihood weighting for dynamic based network, where we don't really expect to have the entire network staring at you because it's repetitive, and I don't want to have the entire network unfolded in front of me. So instead what I should do is I should decide on the number of samples I'm going to use and take them lockstep with me. That's not hard. So instead of taking each sample all the way through the network, I will decide I'm going to have 100 samples. So for each of the samples, I will take them step by step, modifying them in parallel, modifying their weights in parallel. This wouldn't have made that much of a difference for a network that's extensionally available, but it makes a huge difference for dynamic-based networks where you only have the slice available. Right? So what you do is, to go from, let's say, here to here, suppose you decided 100 samples, you would then take 100 samples from this level to the next level. Okay, and 100 samples from next level to the next level. And this way, you'll never ask for more than one slice of the dynamic based network. Very useful. You didn't have to give up anything. Okay, that's point one. This is an idea one that we would use in doing likelihood weighting. Okay, this just becomes sequential filtering, sequential Monte Carlo. Okay. So now, one of the interesting things when you do this is the samples will then become the distribution of the state itself. So the set of samples will themselves become, you know, will approximately describe the distribution of the state, which is rain I. Okay? And so you're taking the distributions in the exact inference, you're taking the distributions in the full form. In the exact inference, you're taking the distributions in the full form. This looked nice and okay here, but one thing you have to remember is this is a very special case of a very simple dynamic based network where you have a Boolean variable, and so each distribution is exactly two numbers. What if it's a continuous variable? Remember, Bayes networks allow continuous variables. What if it's a continuous variable? You could have quite a weirdo distribution. And then you take it from here to here, you get another weirdo distribution, right? And these distributions, normally you would need to have a bunch of parameters to talk about them. Either you have infinite number of numbers, or you need a bunch of parameters. And when you have samples, what you're saying is, I'll just keep the samples themselves. So for example, if the distribution I'm trying to keep is a normal distribution. Actually, normal distribution is a good life for us. In fact, it turns out that the entire normal distribution can be kept by just remembering mu and sigma values, the variance and the mean. Okay? But what if the distribution is not Gaussian? It is some random distribution and hope that the area under that sums to 1. But all that you care about for it to be a probability distribution is that the area sums to 1. Now, how many parameters are needed here? In the worst case, you need infinite number of parameters. Okay? So you really have no hope. When you have continuous variables, you really have no hope of keeping the entire distribution. So when you have, one thing you can do is you can actually keep the samples themselves as the approximation of the distribution, which is in essence what happens when you are doing this step. Okay? So you notice that I kind of threw in these continuous variables, which is something that is actually feasible for Bayes networks. We agreed upon that before itself. Okay? Now that's one idea. The second idea that's very interesting is the following, which is actually a problem for that, the likelihood weighting before too, but it becomes even more of a problem for dynamic Bayes network. So suppose you have a large network and there is an evidence variable here. This is the only variable whose value you know. There are no evidence variables in between. Remember that you always go through the network in the topological order. To make a sample, you start from the top, you would start tossing your coins. Okay? So you would go through this network. In some sense, up until this point, you are essentially generating a sample that is in the empty distribution without evidence. And then you come all the way here and you are surprised that the evidence doesn't agree with the sample. Most of the time, for interesting kinds of scenarios. So for example, what is the probability that people will be glowing red when there is an earthquake? Now, most samples you generate won't have earthquake true. Or they will have earthquake true, and to plug them to earthquake true, the sample's weight becomes 0.000001 because you went through a large network, you know. Okay? So what happens essentially is while the sample does give non-zero weight to the denominator, it's really close to zero. And what happens because of that is when the evidence is downstream, you wind up needing large number of samples to keep the estimation error low. Okay? So for example, here is a picture that shows if you do likelihood weighting on the dynamic Bayes network of this type, with 10 samples, 100 samples, 1,000 samples, 10,000 samples, okay, and these are the error curves. Obviously, this is the 10 sample error curve. So by the time you come up to 15 steps, the error is like 80%. So you're making an estimate, but it's way off. Okay? And then as you increase the number of samples, the error falls down, but it is still exponential. What you would like to have is a curve like this, which is sort of more or less independent of the number of samples, and it keeps the error low. If you can have it, obviously it's an idea worth thinking about. And that's the idea of particle filters. Okay? And I'll explain to you. It's not that hard to understand now that you understood the background. All you're going to do, essentially, is you decide on the number of samples. So in the beginning, let's say at the range t, suppose you decided that, 4 plus 4, 8 plus 2, 10. Suppose you have decided you have 10 samples. Remember that we have already decided we are going to do parallel, all samples in parallel, push through the network. So you decide upfront how many samples you're going to keep, and you're going to push them through the network. Now, one of the interesting things that's going to happen is, if I tell you 10 samples is what you have, right, and if your network looks like this, I mean, your actual distribution looks like this, the biggest worry you have is all the 10 samples wind up sitting here. Because this is the high likelihood, the reason that distribution looks like this is that's the high likelihood area. It's high likelihood not given any evidence. And so all your samples naturally go sit here. And then evidence comes from an area which completely changes your belief, and there are no samples to take that into consideration. Okay? So what you want to do is, given that you have $10, you're going to spread it evenly. 10 samples, you're going to spread it in such a way that they are more representative of the eventual posterior distribution, given the evidence. So to do that, all you do is, you go from range t to range t plus 1, using just the transition matrix. Using the transition matrix, you sample, and you essentially get, again, some samples have range t plus 1 is true, some samples have range t plus 1 false. So from 8 and 2, I went to 6 and 4 here. So now of my 10 samples, 6 are sitting with rain equal to true, 4 are sitting with rain equal to false. Then I look at the evidence. Okay? The evidence basically told me that umbrella is false. That means the guy did not come in with an umbrella. Because he did not come in with an umbrella, these guys are much less able to explain the evidence than these guys. So you actually weight, you increase the weights of these samples. Up until now, these are all, each sample has weight 1. Now, you grow these guys bigger because they are like, they are actually as big as the likelihood that they afford the evidence. So if rain is false, umbrella being false is higher than rain is true. Umbrella is false, we know this. We have seen this as an evidence. So having seen the evidence, these guys shrink and these guys expand. Now normally what's happening is if you don't do anything, these will keep shrinking, 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 and most of these samples are out of the window. They're useless now. This is the step, resampling, where we shift our coins, shift our particles, such that there are more of them in the likely region and less of them in the non-likely region. Remember that this is more indicative of the posterior distribution having seen the weight. And yet, if you think of each sample as equal weight, then you still actually have 6 samples sitting in the unlikely region, given the evidence. You want to change them around, such that more guys are here and less guys are here. So what you do is you resample, so the same 10 samples, from these 10 samples, you resample another new 10 samples. And the probability that you would pick any of these samples into the next iteration would be proportional to its probability, its likelihood right now. So what happens is these guys will get picked up more often, these guys will get picked up less often, and you picked only 10. So probabilistically it turned out in this case that, you know, 8 came here and 2 came there. This is still sampling. I did not decide that exactly 8 will be here and 2 will be here. I used the probabilities as a guidance to do the tossing experiment. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay? So I essentially pushed the guys into the more likely region. So now these guys agree with the posterior more. I have the same 10 coins. I now put it in the part of the, you know, I'm basically, instead of pushing them all in one unlikely place, I'm putting them in the more likely region given the evidence. Okay? This is the idea of particle filter. If you just do that, you get much better performance. Way much better performance. And let me show you, since I could do it today, little example. Okay, so I wish I can make this bigger. Let me just do it. What? Alt enter. No. Oh no, this one. Should not be. What? Oh, VSI. Ah, that's good. Fit player to the player side. Oh, not good. Okay, now. Except it's not really. Video size is 200%. That's good. Okay. So this is, the example is essentially using particle filtering techniques to localize a robot's position. Now let's think about what is involved in doing robotics. You know, there are two ways of doing robotics. One is you tell the robot very good sensor, so it almost knows all the time exactly where it is. The other is you buy the cheap sensors and it has to continuously do filtering and smoothing to figure out where actually it is. And to do the filtering operation, in fact, for large scale networks, the only reasonable idea is approximate inference. Exact inference doesn't scale. Okay, so in this case, The robot is somewhere here in this corridor. Now notice that all it has is like a sonar or a laser sensor, which tells it how far it is from different walls. Now the tricky part, of course, is if it is somewhere here, just using the sonar, it can't tell exactly where in this corridor it is. Okay? Based on when, it's just like you being in your, you know, friend's room. When you woke up, you didn't know exactly where you were. After you threw a couple of things by stepping on the dog or throwing, you know, by, you know, upsetting the, you know, glass of water, you realize, oh, I must be in this room, not in this other room. So you change based on what the evidence that you gather, using your faulty sensors, you keep changing your position. You are localizing yourself. Now to do this, it turns out, you need to do this filtering technique that we just talked about. And as I pointed out, filtering is extremely hard to do exactly if you have continuous transition model. And in particular, the only good continuous transition model that people know how to deal with, and it seems to have used, you know, a reasonable amount of use, is if the transition model from XT to XT plus 1, as well as the transition model from XT plus 1 to ET plus 1, is both a Gaussian. I mean, there's a reason why normal distribution is popular. It just is everywhere. Okay? The reason you are happy with Gaussian distribution here, it turns out, is it's the one distribution that people know where if you start with a Gaussian prior, translate it over the transition, which is a Gaussian, you would get another Gaussian. Then use Bayes network, I mean Bayes rule on the evidence to recompute the posterior, that too will be a Gaussian. So it's Gaussians all the way down. And Gaussians can always be represented with exactly two parameters, sigma and mu. It's such a useful property that the guy who realized this and who pushed this idea is extremely famous, a guy called Rudolf Kalman. And Kalman filtering, which many of you have probably heard sometime or other in your life, is essentially doing filtering over dynamic Bayes networks where all the conditional probability distributions are linear Gaussian. It turns out in that case, it's just so easy. You know, you can recompute what happens at the next level by just recomputing the mu's and sigma. And there are easy ways to do that. And it's particularly, it's reasonably good in many, many scenarios. It's a reasonably good approximation. So as long as Kalman filtering works, everybody is happy. You can do exact inference if you have Kalman filters because you know exact mu's and sigmas. So you can do exact inference. Once you don't have Gaussian distribution, when you have you know any arbitrary distribution, then you no longer have the guarantee that the posterior would have any connections to the previous distribution. In particular, the number of parameters required to exactly represent the posterior distribution keeps growing without bound. In some sense, the posterior gets fragmented, so much so that as you keep going forward, you need even more and more parameters to represent it exactly. So exact representation of continuous distribution during filtering is impossible. So you do approximate inference. This is where particle filters come. So before particle filters, robots would actually try to localize themselves, assuming that, you know, these are all Gaussians, even if they are not Gaussian. Now if you assume something that's not actually holding in the world, you pay the price. So robot will once in a while bang into walls and sometimes bang into small kids, and that's not good. Okay? So the other idea is to start with, you know, allow the true distributions, okay, and then approximate them using the particles and do the particle filtering. So this is why this is interesting. So there's a large amount of connection between this and our class. So here, notice how many samples they are keeping. 40,000 samples. Okay? What is all this red stuff? The robot is actually here in the beginning. What is all the red stuff? That's the likelihood that robot thinks it is in any of these other places. So in the beginning it doesn't know, it could be anywhere. As it starts walking around, it figures out where it is. Okay? Let's see what happens. Samples are shown in red. So in the beginning, of course, the samples are approximating the entire distribution. So the samples are all over the place. But as you go on, you notice that the samples start coming closer and closer to the true position of the robot. Notice that these white regions are good. This basically means the robot knows that it's not likely to be here. There are not enough samples here, that means it's not there at least. Okay? So now it has figured out by this time that it may be here and most likely in the corridor. That's good. You didn't tell it and it still figured this out. By this time, notice what happened. So the particles all converge to the high likelihood region. Okay, and once it converges, you know, it's just going like a little insect all over the place. Very simple idea. Very useful, in fact. Okay. So, let me end with this one slide, which I sort of explained to you earlier itself, which is that DBNs are really a more general case, and particular special cases of DBNs have their own names. I already gave you a name for Kalman filtering. Kalman filters are dynamic Bayes networks where the variables, the transition model is Gaussian. You can allow any number of variables in the state. Kalman filters allow any number of variables in the state, but the way these variables are connected to the next level variables has to be a Gaussian. Okay, and the evidence that sensory matrix, sensory model also has to be a Gaussian. If you allow that, the beauty of Kalman filters is that you can compute the mu and sigma of the new distribution as a weighted summation of the mu's and sigmas of the sensor model and the transition model. So all you need is these two numbers, which are mu's and sigmas of the transition model and the prior. Extremely nice. And to actually appreciate this, you have to understand what would happen if you have to really represent the entire posterior with infinite number of parameters. Okay? So this is the nice thing. In fact, in this particular case, what happened was, in the beginning, this was the, let's say, the distribution as to where it thought, where the robot thought it was. Now, if it projects its position to the next time instant through the transition model. Transition model is noisy because it's probabilistic. So what happens then is its new distribution will be more like this. So it essentially has more variance. It's less sure as to exactly where it is. All the peak is telling you is it's the most likely place where you are. Having projected this, if you then use the Bayes rule and the evidence to recompute your current posterior, the current posterior would look more like this. Where in essence, you are saying, I now have a better idea. You know, the narrower this distribution is, the better idea you have as to where you are, because the less variance. And it also now says, based on the evidence, I believe that I'm here and my variance has reduced. If your sensors are good, this is exactly what they tell you. They reduce the uncertainty. If the sensors are not good, then you're going to depend more on what this guy tells you. And that's why those expressions are really seen, are best seen as weighted summation of the means and variances of the sensor model and the transition model. So there is one special case, and the last one I want to tell you is the other special case is, so in this case you restrict the type of distribution. You keep the number of variables is any number. You can have any number of state variables as long as all of them are connected to each other by Gaussian. The other way you can make life simple is reduce the number of variables and state any distribution. Any distribution is fine, but the variables in making up the state have to be pure. So the special case of that is Markov chain, where you have one variable transitioning from T to T plus 1 to T plus 2 to T plus 3. And it's fully observable. And in the case of Markov chain, the most useful. So before looking, you want to predict. If you look, you know exactly where you are. That's what Markov chain is. It's fully observable, non-deterministic scenario. And then a much more interesting model called hidden Markov model, where the state is still a single variable, but you can't directly observe it. What you can observe is the evidence about the state. So in the Markov chain, you only have the transition model. You don't have the sensor model. That's not there. And Markov chains are very useful, for example, if you need examples, for analyzing page rank is essentially related to a property of the Markov chain given a random surfer going from page to page, page rank in Google. Okay? And then hidden Markov models are all over the place. Again, it's a single variable making up the state, but it's hidden, and you get evidence on that. And for this and this, there are very specialized techniques that have developed even before people had words called Bayes networks and dynamic Bayes networks anywhere in the literature. So in some sense, what you got is the 21st century view of reasoning with temporal probabilistic models. You know, 20th century, we would only mostly have talked about these and these as if they're all special cases with no unifying model. So you should look much happier than you are looking. So we should stop here. Okay. Next class, we'll start doing learning.